Which was Friday.
I'm having a week like that, too. Where am I supposed to be? You said they leave me there.
Good morning. I'd like to call to order the House Interim Committee on Human Services. I'm Vic Gilliam, co-chair with co-chair Carolyn Tomei to my right. I have the honor of presiding for our first order of business because of my involvement with this work group. Committee, I'm very happy to share with you four speakers, and I'm particularly pleased that I'm not one of the speakers, and as I know you are. Come on, committee. Hello. There we go. And I want to just give two or three comments as kind of a background to get your head in the game with this. This task force, excuse me, is not a task force. It's a work group, and that's a semantic issue with President Courtney. If you know the background to that, you'll know what I'm talking about. But this was the Elder Abuse Work Group. It's closely related to, it's not statutorily connected, but it's very closely related to the earlier adult protection anybody?
Some other.
Anybody in the back of the room know what that's called?
Safety team.
Safety team. And I'm sorry I didn't get that correct, but this is a very important group that the new director, Aaron Kelly Seal, who I think is with us today, pulled together in response to concerns over how we treat our most valued and seniors in the state. I've said it before, and I want to make sure everybody hears me now. This was not a blame game. This was not a reactionary group, but it was a very positive group that she pulled together. Their mode of operation was a large group. I dashed over there as many times as I could during our last session and monitored it somewhat closely, but I was not an important player in that. I was, however, a very satisfied customer in that several really important priorities came from that group. We then passed a bill, as you'll recall, to coordinate with, not in competition with, but coordinate with their findings and their recommendations, the recommendations that you see in front of you. So those two groups melded quite nicely. Some of the same players were on both teams, and I want you to understand that. This has really been quite a labor of love. Not everybody agreed on every subject, as you can imagine. But we're very pleased to come to you this morning with these recommendations. So with that, I'm going to start our four task force groups, work groups. We took a little different mode of operation, and that was to divide and conquer. We had several meetings all together, but the real work was done in these four groups that divided, and that's what the recommendations that you'll see in front of you. I'm very grateful to my co-chair, Tomei, for her support and interest in this and your cooperation in letting us make this the sort of the kickoff of this interim meeting. So thank you very much. And I'm going to start with my other co-chair in this work group. And I'm going to ask Representative Hoyle, if she'll come forward, fill in any of the blanks that I missed in the background, and give us, please, your summation on the work group that you chaired. Welcome, Representative Hoyle.
Thank you. For the record, Val Hoyle, I represent House District 14, West Eugene, and Junction City. I was really grateful to be appointed to this work group, and I have to say the people who were at the table came ready to work. It was an amazing group of people from all over, and we really got some things done with fairly little effort on our part in February. We agreed that whatever we brought forward in February, one, couldn't cost any money, and two, couldn't be controversial because it was important. So this is low-hanging fruit, but it really, really is going to make a difference in the lives of some of our most vulnerable populations. So I was grateful to be a part of it, but more importantly, I was honored to be able to work with this caliber of people. And you'll hear as the people that come and speak after me. It was incredible. The subcommittee I had was the one on criminal background checks. to make sure that the people who are taking care of our seniors are qualified, that our seniors are safe, and that we're using that our background check system is efficient. Again, we've got the right people in the right place, and using our dollars and our time efficiently. The members of the committee were Senator Jackie Winters, Jeff Aiken, the Operations Manager, DHS Background Check Unit, Jerry Cohen from AARP Oregon, and Grover Simmons, the Independent Adult Foster Home Association, also Senator Floyd Przybski. He's not listed. You should have a page here. He's not listed there, but he was on our subcommittee. I wouldn't make that up. It's true. So on our recommendations, the first is that we implement what's called a wrap-back system. Right now, with when we do background checks, sometimes, depending on the situation, we'll use fingerprints. We'll go through the state police program. If the person tells us that they haven't lived out of state in the past 5 years, we don't do as extensive a background check. But that doesn't seem to be the best system, because if someone has committed a crime in another state, they might not tell us that they lived out of state in the past 5 years. So at the end of the day, we want a program that's efficient. We have, if you have in-home care workers and they work in multiple counties, they have to get multiple background checks once a year. So someone works in Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah County, they actually have to go get three different background checks. This just doesn't seem efficient. I've also been talking to a number of other people, Representative Holvey and Representative Nathanson specifically, and there are many agencies that are looking at a program. We shouldn't have our background checks a different system for each program. That is also not efficient. Doesn't seem to make sense. So a wrap-back system is a system that it would mean that the person that was wanting to work in this industry would have their fingerprints kept on file with the state police. And if that person committed a crime, that the employer would be informed. In 2014, there's a plan to have the wrap-back system implemented nationally. This would mean that we wouldn't have to have multiple background checks for people, wouldn't have to have background checks every year or every other year, and again, employers would be notified if a crime was committed. There is a very, very robust program for if someone's accused and they don't feel like it's accurate, there actually is a robust system for them to challenge that. So that's really important. Our suggestion was that initially this be an opt-in program. There are a lot of people across the board that would prefer to have a system like this. Over time, it will cost less because we don't have to do as many background checks and the state pays for that. And two, they don't have to wait as long. For instance, some of the in-home care workers, adult foster home care workers, every year they have to go get every employee checked and have fingerprints done. And they would prefer to be able to do something more efficient and know if we've got someone that has no history of committing a crime, has actually been doing a very good job, it doesn't seem to make sense that we're doing multiple background checks. But we do want to make sure that if someone has committed a crime and shouldn't be taking care of people that are vulnerable, we would like them out as soon as possible. Again, the current system doesn't do either especially well. So the governor's office is working with multiple agencies to work on implementing this system. There is a federal grant that we can apply for that has a 2-to-1 match in dollars, and we can match dollars that we already use, so we can get up to $2 million for helping to implement this program. So our recommendation is that we work with the other agencies in the governor's office to implement this wrap-back system. So the second piece is that we wanted to revise the Never Never list. If you remember, the Never Never list is a list of crimes that if you commit them, you should never, ever be allowed to work with vulnerable populations. When we looked at the data, There are certain crimes that are committed that were not on the list that our law enforcement agents asked us to put on the list. For instance, adding animal abuse 1, aggravated animal abuse 1, forgery 1, and child neglect. We're asking that child neglect be added to the 10-year drug-related crimes, as drugs are often involved in this conviction. So these are crimes that our law enforcement agents said, when people commit these crimes, you really don't want them around vulnerable populations. The data shows that these are people that are prone to be abusers. The crimes that we would like taken off the list, although there would be waiting periods for hire and a weigh test means that if there's a 3, 5, or 10-year waiting period, that there is a panel that interviews the person and determines, okay, just because you've waited your period of time does not mean that you automatically get to work with this population. You have to have this weigh test. And those crimes are public indecency, private indecency, invasion of personal privacy, theft 1, theft of services if charged as a felony, computer crime if charged as a felony, criminal possession of a forgery. Actually, we're taking off criminal possession of forgery device. So everything up to computer crime if charged as a felony. And the reason that we've asked these be taken off the Never Never list is that the data shows that people who have committed these crimes over a period of time, if they haven't committed another crime over a period of time, generally do not recommit. So we want to give people the opportunity to work. But we also want to keep seniors safe. That was my subcommittee. Those are our recommendations. Did anybody have any questions?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Please.
I was sitting in on the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday, and I heard some testimony on these issues, and I know that you will be sitting in on the House Judiciary Committee today, so it'll be interesting to hear your feedback regarding this issue. So thank you for coming today, and thank you for working on this subcommittee.
Thanks for having us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Representative Hoyle. Actually, I'm giving you a serious and honest question. So what was the reasoning for wanting to take the theft off of there? Because we're sending people into homes where there's small antiques that are easily picked up that people wouldn't notice that are family heirlooms. So, I mean, some of those, removing them from the Never Ever list, I would have issues or trouble supporting just because I know what's in a lot of people's homes, and someone coming in there, it's like, oh, they're not going to notice that ring gone.
Right. Well, we checked with law enforcement, and again, what the data shows is that theft one specifically and theft of services is that data shows that over a period of time, if someone hasn't recommitted, and again, they are interviewed, and if you're 22 years old and you did something stupid and you stole more than $750 worth of items, and now you're 40 years old, you haven't recommitted, you've lived an upstanding life, but you did something really stupid when you were younger, and we have a number of cases like this, we'd like to be able to have the opportunity to have those people work and support themselves. So really, it is a case-by-case basis. Every single case is overseen, but we've just seen with these types of cases that people who are younger or made some bad decisions really are able to turn their life around. And it isn't like someone who's a serial thief or someone that has, someone that we think would steal from people or again, would take advantage of vulnerable populations. But we would like to have the opportunity. This doesn't mean that they automatically can work there, but we'd like to have the opportunity for people who really turned their life around, really who made a couple of bad choices, that doesn't really indicate that for the rest of their life with these crimes, and that's what the data shows, that, if you do something stupid once or twice, I'm sure you've never done it, but, some of us have, just once or twice in your life you do something stupid, it doesn't mean you should have to pay for the rest of your life. If you've paid for the crime and done your time and proven that you can actually be a valuable member of society. And again, we've got some people from law enforcement who are here who might have some more to say about that. But again, we went over the list very clearly, and we had a number of cases of literally like that. Geez, I was, you know, I was 22, I got drunk, we stole something, and it was really one of the dumbest things I've ever done, but now I'm fine. So that, those are the people that we're trying to deal with here.
I'll wait and follow up with law enforcement.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Representative. Other questions for our colleague? Now, Representative Hoyle, I hope you can stay. If you can, I understand everybody's got committee meetings, but as we go through this, you'd be a valuable responder if we need you.
Okay, I will stay for as long as I can. I do have another committee meeting.
That's all we can ask, but thank you very much for your testimony and for your service with this group. Okay, so committee members, we have heard the first of four reports, that one obviously on criminal background checks. The next one you see on your list is elder abuse definitions. And I'm going to ask Clackamas County DA John Wentworth to come forward. And John's no stranger here. You will remember during the last session, I asked John to come in because he had given an excellent presentation to the previous group that I mentioned on a great presentation, I'll never forget it, on multidisciplinary teams. Thank you. What'd you say, Representative?
Energies.
Yes, exactly. Multidisciplinary teams. And he gave that presentation here, which I thought was important. He'd given it to the other group. He's been a valuable member of our task force, and he's going to tell us a little bit about some of the problems with narrowing down the definition. We don't claim that we've got the ultimate final definition, but we did want to make it manageable. And with that, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is John Wentworth. I'm a prosecutor with the Clackamas County DA's office. I supervise our domestic violence and vulnerable adult unit. So all elder abuse cases that come in from Clackamas County come to my unit and are distributed. So that could be financial fraud cases or abuse of elders, for example, or people with disabilities. So that's my background. And much of our work on this committee began, I think, through the frustrations that I shared with you when I discussed our work on creating a protocol on the Clackamas County multidisciplinary team. What we found, and let me give credit to the people who were involved in the committee, including Representative Hoyle and Senator Przanski, Fred Steele and Lark Weisham and Lauren Rhodes, who were all valuable in their assistance in helping us bridge gaps between definitions of abuse that people in the field, in the social service field, work with, and comparing that and contrasting that to the definitions that we operate with in law enforcement. And
John, just a second, little housekeeping. We're having feedback. It's not your problem, your fault, I should say. Can you push that away or maybe away from the other mic?
I will.
Okay, thank you. Go right ahead.
So there was recognition that when we have, and this is what I shared with you before when I spoke to you, when we have...
Why don't you push that other mic way?
He's coming.
So sorry.
Just one tone.
I'll try. I'm an attorney.
this usually happens when we're fighting.
I get feedback all the time. I'm used to it.
This is positive feedback.
It's positive feedback. Good. So to kind of fill in the gaps there, when we began working more closely through the multidisciplinary team with people in the field working for Adult Protective Services and bringing law enforcement to the table as well, what we found is there was some frustration in the communication between the two groups because the definitions of abuse that people in social services work with are oftentimes very different from the definitions of abuse that we operate with in law enforcement. What I also shared before, and I want to remind you, is that in my view, coming into this relatively newly in the last year and a half, my experience in part was in prosecuting child abuse, child sexual abuse. And in my view, we are in the elder abuse realm about 20 years or 25 years behind where we are in child abuse. So if you look at child abuse statutes and compare them to criminal statutes in terms of what the DHS works with in the child abuse realm, they're very similar because that work's already been done between bridging those two gaps. And so this subcommittee was charged with identifying whether or not we could accomplish something similar in the elder abuse realm. To cut to the chase, what we found is there's far too much work to do in that area than we could accomplish in the time that we had in this subcommittee. Our recommendation ultimately is that we continue the work because I still think it's valuable work to be done. But in terms of the work that the social service agencies do, their definitions of abuse are so broad and understandably so in some regards. They want to make sure that they're capturing things that are occurring that maybe aren't necessarily criminal. But they can be so broad as to capture things that perhaps we don't intend to. And so if we have mandatory reporting statutes and we say all abuse gets reported to law enforcement, well, okay, but maybe not necessarily everything is a crime and require a criminal consequence. And if that's the case, then how do we proceed? We know we need to proceed administratively, but should we be calling it abuse when it isn't necessarily abuse? For example, self-neglect. Self-neglect is abuse. So you know, we may be capturing too much there. And what that should look like, how we should change it, was the subject of some spirited discussion. But certainly no compromise, no agreement could be made because there was just too much to do. And if I can speak more broadly, in my work with vulnerable adults, and that includes people with disabilities, if you look at the statutes that we work with on our multidisciplinary team for mandatory reporting, this is an issue that continues into other areas as well. Because our laws have been cobbled from different areas without any discussion with how the definition in one part of the Oregon Revised Statutes might be similar to or very different from the very same word used in a different part of the statutes. All well-meaning, gets to some issue, but when you try to combine those for mandatory reporting purposes, for example, it can be very frustrating to those of us in the field. Areas that, I've discussed a lot of those. One of the other recommendations that we had was that there was a recommendation that, and we're going to touch on this, I think, in another part of the presentation, but we had a recommendation that there are things that we can do even within the criminal realm that don't have a fiscal impact necessarily, but can improve the services that we provide to elders. For example, a recognition that in the child abuse realm, for example, if a person is convicted of a crime of child abuse, that conviction cannot be expunged. So this kind of piggybacks on what the representative was testifying to just earlier. However, if you commit a similar crime against an elder and you're 35 and you want to go into the healthcare field and work in that field at the age of 40, in that three-year gap, you can have that crime against the elder expunged, and no one would know. That wouldn't be captured in the background check. And that's a concern, because obviously if we do have a never-never list, if there are crimes that we agree, if a person commits, they should never be eligible to work with elders again, you can't allow for an expunction.
Hold on just a second, John.
So help us understand how that can be expunged.
Let's say I commit a crime. Against an elder, I commit a theft,
right?
And I get convicted. In 3 years, if I go through all, I jump through all the hoops. 3 years, if I jump through all the hoops on my probation, I can even have my probation terminated early. But it's the 3 years from the conviction. I can apply for, and will be granted. Most judges would grant an expunction because I've done everything I'm supposed to do on probation. I checked in with my probation officer in a timely fashion, and I paid all my fines and fees, and I went through any counseling that they recommended. I can go right back into the profession and do it again.
So because that's in statute now.
Yes.
So that statute is very different from child abuse.
Yes.
And it seems like what you're recommending is that it be a very similar
yes
statute.
It would seem to make a lot of sense.
Oh, yes. Okay, so, thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Now, one recommendation that we had, and this does have a fiscal impact, although in my view it would be modest, but I'm sensitive to that issue, is that if you were to commit a crime against a child under the age of 10, that's a felony, but the crime being assault. If you assault a child under the age of 10, that's a felony. It's an assault in the third degree. It's a Class C felony. If you commit a crime against an elder, so a person over the age of 65, it's a misdemeanor unless you have a caregiving relationship. Then it's a felony. So in my realm, you know, where I see this come about is you might have very fragile, you know, frail adults whose adult children are assaultive of them. If the children aren't in a caregiving relationship, each of those assaults is a misdemeanor. So, you know, if we're going to be consistent in how we're treating those people in our community who are the most vulnerable, it would seem to me that that would be a reasonable. Does that happen often? No. And that's why I'm saying it would be a modest fiscal impact to include that as a felony. But I'm aware that, you know, that can be an issue. But that's a recommendation that our group came up with. There was also some discussion about whether in the civil realm when we're dealing with elders, there's a concern about undue influence by family members or others against the elder to engage in financial fraud. Now, currently, there's no criminal component to that. I mean, if you're acting with undue influence, there's no enhancement in terms of sentencing. There's no particular impact to that. But there was some discussion in our group that perhaps there should be, and we didn't get any further than that. But except to recognize that does happen, and it seems like perhaps a gap in the system. Another excellent idea that came about, and this would have to be worked on, I think, further, was to appoint an independent review panel of experts in the field of quality improvement, protection, and safety. We had a recommendation that it would include Oregon Patient Safety Commission, Acumentra, who's Oregon's medical quality improvement organization, DHS, a geriatric clinician, perhaps a prosecutor, a consumer in the field also, and to deal with some of these administratively concerning events that aren't necessarily criminal, to provide advice and guidance to those in the healthcare profession on how to improve the quality of the services that they're providing in recognition that some form of, and I will use the term that we currently use, abuse has occurred. It may not be criminal abuse, but there is a concern that there's behavior going on or being allowed within the facility that should be addressed, not for sanctions, but for education and to improve the work that's being done. The providers that we spoke to were very appreciative of this idea, that everything they do shouldn't come with it a sanction. And perhaps, you know, you can have a very, an outstanding care facility that reports every event of abuse that goes on, as they're supposed to do. And if I were to check that as a consumer, I would see this high quality facility and say, well, look at all the, you know, the events of abuse that they have, and compare that to a facility that rarely reports. They're not a quality facility. And I look at those two and I would have a misimpression of where I should send my family. And we're concerned about that. And we think there should be an educational opportunity and perhaps a more accurate reporting of what's going on, what's really going on in the field. And this group, this panel, would help address that. With that, I've discussed what the potential challenges are, I think. But if there are questions, I'd be happy to entertain any.
Any questions on this part?
Representative White. May I follow up? Because I think this is probably the person I need to be asking my questions to.
I will give, just before you ask your question, I was going to say to you, and this is our best law enforcement related witness, we have an excellent member who is not here today. He's a detective from Forest Grove that's been in front of the committee before, and I wanted to tell you that I'd be happy to put you in touch with him. He unfortunately has been put on a pretty high profile case and could not join us today. Please go ahead.
I'm on a high-profile case myself here today. So it's what I was kind of getting at, and Representative Hoyle got around it. But like with theft and things like that, some people, I mean, will steal little things their whole life and never really think anything of it. And we put them in that environment. They may only get caught once, but it's still something they do continually, and they never get caught again doing it. And we're looking at putting people in homes. And senior, I mean, they have things that, well, like rings. You could sell on the street for maybe $50 or $60. But to the family, I mean, this was their great-great-grandparents' wedding ring, possibly, or something like that. I know my wife's wedding ring, it's nothing fancy, but it was my great-grandmother's wedding ring, and it's something that's been in our family forever. So knowing that those things are in someone's house and they're very easy to pick up, the theft thing I'd have a little bit of issues with, even if we put 10, 15 years on it to remove that off of the rolls. So I'm just wondering what the thought process with taking that off is, because, I mean, we have a lot of valuable heirlooms in my grandmother's house, and they're not in my house, even though I could probably have some of them because I don't want the clutter in my house. But there are also things that are important to the family that nobody else cares about except the family.
It is the most fair and the most unfair to ask me, because as a prosecutor, my role, my job, my responsibility that I take very seriously is to protect the public, and I share your concerns. I'm also aware and sensitive to what Representative Hoyle was talking about in terms of things that people do on an occasion in their life that is not representative of their life as a whole. And my frustration, and that I share this with victims all the time, is that on the case-by-case basis that I get cases, I don't know whether this is an individual isolated incident in a person's life of bad judgment or a continuing pattern of behavior. And in that tie, in the criminal justice system, it always goes to the presumption of innocence, or the presumption that someone isn't worse than we first thought. And that can be frustrating, because I may believe that there's more going on, but unless I can prove it, and that's the standard, we don't know. So I share your concerns. Let me give you another example. I just prosecuted a case involving a woman who was going in and taking, she was caring for a man, she's from the Congo, and she's been taking his cell phone and calling friends and family abroad, thinking that it was free, that those minutes wouldn't be attributed to his cell phone because he had a free plan. Well, she was wrong. So when he gets his cell phone bill, it's $600. She was very upset at herself. She was embarrassed. She was otherwise doing a great job in terms of caring for him. But she was wrong in the consequences that occurred to that. She immediately paid it back. She won't work in that field again, I expect, unless she's able to get it expunged. But I didn't attribute that as some necessarily, you know, a pattern of behavior that she shouldn't be working in the field any further. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but I don't know. And that just seemed to be one of those cases where her judgment was really, really lacking, and especially in terms of her perceived consequences to the person that she was caring for. So the theft statute captures that as well. So to answer your question, there's no great or easy answer except to say we generally presume, unless we can prove differently, that you know, an instant of bad judgment is just that instant of bad judgment.
If I may follow up,
please.
So, yeah, I mean, that case is a prime example, but it's also one where they probably could have reached a civil compromise. Hey, I didn't know I was doing this. I'll pay you the $600, and it wouldn't end up on her record anyway. Where if she intentionally was doing it and had no intention of paying it back, then it would be on her record if she was convicted. And So that's where it's kind of a gray area. I mean, that one that you described, to me, is an easy issue because it's not going to end up on her record if she's going to pay it back, because if somebody did that to my phone and they paid it back, I wouldn't have any problems with it.
And as a victim, you always have that option of attempting to enter into a civil compromise. I can tell you, in what I do, I would oppose it. We'd go before a judge, there'd be a hearing, and the judge would make the decision about whether the civil compromise should be allowed. My argument would be, I think it was a lapse in judgment. I don't know whether this is reflective of more her character in the big picture, and until we know that by walking her through the process of putting her on probation and doing those things, we'll never know. So as an advocate for the community, even though the victim may disagree and say, look, I got my $600 back and I don't care, as an advocate for the community, I would feel like I'd have to go in and say, let's take a step back, let's pause, and let's see who we're working with here.
I may follow up with one last.
One more, please.
So, because pretty much got to where my primary concern is with some of these issues. I'm just trying to figure the best way to address this, because there's the person who has the lapse in judgment, like Representative Hoyle did, mm-hmm. that she was talking about. And
we should let the record show that she wasn't actually admitting anything. It was hypothetical. And so, her reference to cereal theft was breakfast cereal theft. She was much younger, but go ahead.
So, but with that, it's how do we put a timeline on it? Because when we put it in the judgment of individuals, and we see this in front of this committee in Human Services with children in the foster care system, things like that, where we have agents, I mean, even with my dealing with Department of Human Services, where they want to put the child back with the parent all the time, not looking at, hey, they've been in jail two or three times for drugs and everything else, but they put the kids back with the parent and then they get taken away. And so I'm just wondering if we could put, hey, it's got to be 10 years or something like that before we look at this. I mean, because when you make that lapse in judgment, if I go out and make a bad decision, I know, okay, I'll never be able to do this job again, and I took that risk working there and knowing that. And I have to own up for my own responsibilities, too, for my lapse in judgment. So, and those are learning things for you when you're 22, 23, so you never do it again. But it also means you have to make different career choices when you make that bad decision or choice.
And out of fairness to me, I wasn't on that subcommittee, and the recommendations that you're making, and perhaps Representative Hoyle can step in, but there are compromises that can be made. I don't know if that was discussed further.
Do I have to reintroduce myself?
For the record.
For the record, Val Hoyle, representing House District 14, West Virginia, Junction City. That's why this is on a permanent review list, so that any time someone is convicted of this crime, there is a permanent, there will always be a review and a certain period of time. I believe it's 5 years?
It's permanent.
But how long before you can apply?
5.
Yeah, 5 years. So someone commits theft one, you cannot apply for this review you can't apply to work in this field for 5 years. And then after 5 years, you're permanently on review. So anytime for the rest of your life that you apply to work in this field, there is a review and a weighing test where they have to come in and determine, was this a one-off just bad choice? Like, just you didn't think that you were going to actually have to pay for those phone calls, but then you paid it back, and there's nothing in your history. Plus, you have other things that show that you're a productive member of society and did a good job. Or is this something where you really don't look like the type of person that we should be putting with vulnerable members? So it's permanently reviewed. There's a 5-year wait period, and there is a weighing test, so it is not automatic. They actually have to go through a committee to determine whether or not this was a one-off thing or something exceptional, or this really is not the type of person we want working there. So just to clarify the weighing part. Sorry, didn't mean to take your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you for that clarification. If there's no more questions for this presenter, I'm going to move on. We have two more.
Thank you.
And thank you, John. You know, in committee members, when you look at the group that's participated, John's a great example of somebody who fit this task, this work group, into his schedule. We've got people from the private sector, and I want to make sure everybody knows how supportive the department was. Many of those folks are in the room right now. And everybody pulled together, and there's the next speaker is another example of it, and I'd like to ask Gail Gustafson if she'd come up. Gail's from Rivermark Credit Union, and she helped us on the committee that I mentioned a second ago. This is the follow-up on the adult protection team that the director pulled together. Now, this is an important part because the work that that group did ended up in at least 25 great recommendations. Now, we couldn't tackle all of them, and Representative Widener's question demonstrated the relationship between all four of our committees. A lot of this work spilled over. That's why we all sort of pulled together, and why Representative Hoyle came up. But this committee was specifically pulled together to try and bring the top recommendations from the original committee to the work of this work group. So with that, Gail, we're very happy you're here. Thank you for your participation, and for I know we kind of asked you at the last minute to fill in, but you're just the right person, so welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gail Gustafson. I'm Senior Vice President of Financial Services with Rivermark Community Credit Union in Beaverton. Representative Gilliam just gave you a good overview of what our committee's purpose was, to review the work done by this adult protective safety team. Previously, they did a great deal of research and had a large number of recommendations. And our subcommittee narrowed that down, focused that, and are here to recommend two top key recommendations from that work. The first recommendation that we have for you is the same number one recommendation that the Adult Protective Safety Team made, which is to create a statewide call center for elder abuse reports. This would be one number, a central location for anyone to call to report any abuse or suspected abuse, whether this would be somebody in a resident facility, an employment, or a resident, or family member, someone from the general public. It would serve the purpose as one number centralized. A key result by having a statewide call center would be to eliminate the confusion that exists today for people on who to call. Do they call Adult Protective Services? Do they call law enforcement? There is absolute confusion over that. And then there's also the fear that you might be calling the wrong place, which can result in somebody not making the call at all, especially if you're not sure, especially if it's just suspected and you need some help to vet that out and figure out what is this and what should I do with it. Recommendation is that this call center would have some extended hours. Currently, there is an Adult Protective Services call line, though it's 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, and it's also not widely known that it exists. Certainly in some communities it's known, but not necessarily the general public. And so this would also take care of the confusion of what to do if something is discovered after hours. Currently, the police get a lot of calls after hours that really they're not the best resource to handle it, nor are they the ones to determine what should they do. So this call center would be staffed with people who would hear the concern, vet that out, and make a decision. It is abuse. It's not here's what should happen. That doesn't exist today. Our committee recommends utilizing the 211 system. We felt that 211 is an easy number to remember, and there is a system that exists today. It was certainly our desire to not recreate any wheel, if a wheel didn't have to be recreated. Though the 211 system, this is beyond the full scope of what the 211 system does today, but we have a belief and a recommendation that it can be utilized, that likely the APS call center staff that exists today would be part of that, though we do believe and acknowledge that there would be some additional staff, some additional training required to create this and turn the 211 system into a centralized call center to take all these calls for elder abuse reports. So we do believe there'd be some fiscal impact, though it wasn't within the scope of our work group's work to figure that out. So, but there are at least existing resources for that. So that is our number one recommendation to be created. Our second recommendation...
Mr. Chair, can I ask another
question? Please do.
Thank you very much. I visited the 211 Center earlier this week and came away very impressed with it.
You did too.
But I don't think they said, you had a nice visit with you. Part of the problem is that it's not yet statewide. Is a part of the proposal scaling it to the rest of the state, which I think is something we'll probably have before us anyway?
Our recommendation is that 211 would be utilized statewide for the purpose of elder abuse reports. Our work did not span to try to figure out should 211, the other purposes that it's, well, the purpose it serves today, should it be statewide, should it be expanded? That wasn't part of our work. But we do recommend that 211 is the resource for reporting any elder abuse or suspected elder abuse, the place to call statewide.
And 211 came up constantly in our conversations, and as we craft a bill, I'm interested in input on how we can either utilize it as in its current state or tailor it for this particular need.
I was really impressed. I just wondering what happened to the county that doesn't have 211 coverage. Mm-hmm. Can they still make the call to wherever it goes?
It's a great question. I don't think we know the answer to that right now.
Thank you, Representative Greenlich. Our second recommendation is that the state should develop or secure from something existing a competency-based training program for investigations. The Adult Protective Safety Team's recommendations had about four of their top 10 recommendations involved training and competency training for various groups, and our subcommittee wrapped a few of those recommendations into one as our top two recommendations that we're presenting today. The training program would cover basic standards for investigations and involve recognizing and detecting all forms of abuse, including physical abuse, sexual abuse, financial abuse and exploitation, neglect, self-neglect, all the forms of abuse that are critical for general knowledge and awareness. There is a facility that exists already that is designed and set up to perform some of that type of training in relation to the investigations, namely the Oregon Public Safety Academy here in Salem. I've not been there personally, but Detective Matt Smith, who is the chair of our subcommittee, uses that and speaks extraordinarily highly of it, as well as Senator Winters, who was part of our meetings. And it sounds like it's a facility that is already designed and set up to perform this kind of training. So specifically for report writing, evidence collection, sexual assault investigation, so it already exists, and we would recommend that that facility and the resources there would be used for that portion of the training. Then the other scope of this training that we feel is necessary is a little bit broader that we combined in this recommendation, and that would involve elder abuse prevention, early detection, abuse screening, and that training would be designed to be deliverable to multiple audiences. It would include employees at residence facilities and the residents themselves, their families, other providers of services to seniors, including financial institutions, where we see a lot of the financial exploitation occur, and the general public. So we do believe that there are training programs that exist today that could be used or modified to fill this need. Again, the scope of our week of our work was in weeks and not months, so we don't have that training to present, but that's part of our recommendation that be created, and we believe that there are already a lot of resources that exist that could fill that need. So those are our two key recommendations. We had some other recommendations that are not at the kind of scale as our key ones, but we did also work on feel there's a need in the area of public education and transparency and accountability. Some of that is what John Wentworth was just speaking about. And there are states that have utilized public awareness campaigns and training programs, and we feel it would be useful to explore some of those to, again, just educate the general public to help them understand and recognize and detect the signs of abuse that we think that is not as evident and known as it should be. And then we also had recommendations around improving relationships with law enforcement, establishing points of contact, regular communication in each county, and we would certainly love to see the kind of adult multidisciplinary team in every county that you've heard about in Clackamas County. So I'd be happy to take any questions on our top two recommendations if there are any others.
Any questions about this presentation?
Now, the directors are not going to like me for this, but Director Kelly Seals here. I know you're going to testify for us in a later section on budget notes. But if you have a question for this report or another one, we'll entertain those. And if you have any comment on this particular section or any part of this, I hope you know you are welcome to come forward at this point. But I'm not. Well, I am putting you on the spot, but it's not. It's not to be mean. It's because you've been so helpful, and particularly this section, which addressed, you know, the 25 recommendations that came out of the original group. So thank you for responding.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services. We already have been working on putting together what I would call sort of implementation plans around the top 10 recommendations that came out of the Adult Safety and Protection Team, and work is already underway on the two priority recommendations of the subcommittee as well. As has been noted, may be some costs associated with both of these recommendations, and our goal is to minimize those costs, redeploy existing resources as much as possible so as to be able to move forward with as much implementation as we can. I too have visited 211. I actually went out to the with Detective Smith to the and our head of the Office of Investigations and Training to the training center for I call it DPSST. I apologize, it's an acronym, and I don't know what it stands for, but Department of Protection and Safety. I'm sure I'm getting it wrong, but we went to the training center. We had great conversations with the head of the training center and his lead training consultant. And so really what we're wanting to be able to bring back to you are some ideas of what it would take, what other resources we have to be able to get at least partially there if we can't get fully there. And we are looking forward to having the opportunity in February to come back to you with a full presentation about what we've done.
Good, and we look forward to that. Colleagues, you can't go through this kind of an examination and process without coming up with something that's going to cost money, and I'm sorry. And that's one of the problems we have sitting here every day. Right now, as we speak, I'm sure the flowery news from the economic forecast is floating through the building. This is a very serious time. However, is that what the number is?
107.
If this is a priority, and if we are serious about protecting those most vulnerable, particularly our senior population, we can find ways to take advantage of existing resources, as an example in these two recommendations, but we are going to have to do the tough work of elbowing for some extra money. And that's just going to be part of the reality of doing these bills. But thank you for your being upfront about that, but also for your follow-up, and again, for your cooperation. So I'm glad you're here for this. If there's no other questions about this section, we'll move on to the next one.
Thank you very much, Gail. And our last presenter is Mary Yeager, another friend of this committee. And Mary has worked very hard with us. As you know, she'll self-identify, but she's the long-term care ombudsman for the state. And we're glad you're here. The subcommittee that you are reporting on is investigations and data reporting. So welcome, Mary.
Thank you very much. And for the record, Mary Yeager, the long-term care ombudsman. And what our agency does is responds to consumer complaints and concerns in 43,000, excuse me, by a potential of 43,000 long-term care residents across the state of Oregon. So we're very proud that we have over 200 volunteers who work anywhere from 10 to 30 hours a week, both responding to concerns and then reporting on them, both in a state database and a federal database. But to that end, I think you've heard from the three other presenters many of the items we brought up, so I will skip over the repetitive ones. But before I do that, I want to say a thank you to Fred Steele, who was on our committee representing Community APS, Detective Smith, who you've heard a lot about from the Forest Grove Police Department. Somehow he always manages not to be here. Very important investigation. The governor's in his territory, and today he's got yet another concern. So he was extremely valuable. A thank you to Brady Scott. Brady runs the Coquille owned and operated facility in Bandon. Drove all the way to Salem on numerous occasions to be part of this. To Jerry Cohen from AARP, and also to you, Representative Gilliam, for the time you spent with our committee. I'd like to focus on just a few of our recommendations. The first one being an echo of those two before me about a statewide call system, but particularly one that would allow us to have after-hour calls. As we know, many of these situations don't happen during business hours. So when people actually have the courage to call or enough concern to call, it would be terrific if there were a way to have a live person answering. I can speak to the vulnerable seniors, people with disabilities, and the family members that our agency deals with. And it is often an act of courage to finally report something, and it would be terrific if there were actually a person who was live to take that call rather than an answering machine. The previous group talked about professional awareness and actions. Our group also shared concern about who are mandatory reporters for elder abuse versus child abuse in the state of Oregon. You heard the director talk about multidisciplinary training. Our group also really felt strongly that now is the time. Now is the time for more training from all disciplinary points of view to help curb this rising problem in the state of Oregon. Finally, just a note on improving the investigatory process. Our group represented both Community APS and Facility APS. It was kind of a surprise to many of us to learn that 70 to 75% of the calls they get are from Community APS. A lot larger than, I guess, initially many of us would have guessed. But again, the courage to report something to the state, to the government, that is supposed to be set up to be the safety net for these vulnerable people, we would urge this committee and urge the recommendations to really try to clarify the process by which people get information back. It's often a lengthy, lengthy process. We acknowledge that the agency is understaffed, has other priorities at times, but again, if you are that person making a call on behalf of a loved one, or a neighbor, or someone from your community. We believe strongly that as the state of Oregon, we need to provide a much more timely response and one that is in plain language. So there's a quick overview of what we discussed. I would like to echo what you said as chair, sir. We worked with amazingly talented people who gave many, many, many hours of time, and this brief summary doesn't begin to capture the passion and experience that people brought to the table. So I would just like to, on the record, thank everyone for their help. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mary, and thank you for all the work that you do. I just want to bring out another statistic, which is always floors me. Of the 43,000 residents that long in long-term care, how many never get a visitor?
Oh, it's, you know, it would be worth actually doing a poll in the state of Oregon. But from reports from our volunteers, from reports from our staff, the overwhelming number is somewhere between 60 and 70% of people that our volunteers deal with who say they don't have a family member, they don't have a visitor, they don't have a community member who comes to see them. So oftentimes, while our volunteers and staff are responding to what started as a complaint or a concern, many times it turns into, wow, it's a social contact from the outside world.
Thank you. That is just such an astounding figure.
Yes.
Thank you, Mary.
On the issue of mandatory reporting, what are the drawbacks to having everybody above a described age be mandatory reporters? We've had a couple of cases in my district in the past year that got tangled up in their underwear over whether or not somebody should have reported, or uncertainty about whether they were mandatory reporters, or in one case they weren't, I guess, mandatory reporters. It seems to me like it's a social obligation. I don't know what you make 15, 16, some age, but and make it so easy for the public service announcements too to drill down that everybody is responsible for being mandatory reporters of elder and child abuse.
Co-chairs and Representative Thompson, I'm not an attorney. I'm merely an ombudsman. But I would personally and professionally share your point of view. There are experts in the room that can explain the peculiarities about Oregon statutes. But personally and professionally, I agree with you. It seems to me that if we see something, we should say something.
A couple of sessions ago, we had a bill that made pharmacists mandatory reporters of child abuse. And that came about because the pharmacists came in and said, we want to be. Mm-hmm. And it never occurred to me that they weren't. Why wouldn't, you know, why is that an issue? It just seems like it is something that we could take a big step forward if we just defined mandatory reporter as everybody.
And co-chairs, I would leave that to your summary of our work and going forward, but it is a really valid point.
Yeah, we had discussions about both issues that you bring up, what's required and how do we encourage people just to be more responsible or aware. And I think in some of our discussions that was an important part of a, you want to call it a public awareness campaign, that we all have a responsibility to surround this situation, to report this situation, and we've got to go a long way. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, colleagues, but in our training at the beginning of each session, this is not included. Am I right? I don't recall anything about...
We are mandatory reporters.
But do we specifically address it in the training? As far as... I know we're mandatory reporters, but as
being
far
elder
as... Elder abuse.
Oh, elder abuse.
And I don't recall actually being told that's part of our responsibility.
But that's the part of the issue. I mean, are we or are we not? Who cares? We should be, you know. And the other issue, which I think was eliminated very recently with the Penn State situation, what constitutes the valid report? You know, if I told the janitor that I saw somebody, you know, abusing an elderly person, does that let me off the hook? I don't think so. You know, there needs to be...
Sounds like Penn State, right?
Yeah, there need to be some standards. A report, a valid report, is da-da-da-da-da. And if we combine the mandatory reporting with a description of what's a valid report, we could probably go a long way in public service announcements to get closer to the problem. 2013, Representative Gilliam, we will do that.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Anybody from our group want to comment further on that? If not, we'll move on, but I just want to give everybody else, of course, a chance. Okay, Mary, thank you.
No other questions.
Thank you for your presentation. Representative Hoyle, any closing thoughts or comments from you?
Colleagues, we're going to move forward on these issues, and you'll be hearing more from me and from Representative Hoyle on possible committee bills related to this. But I'll save that for a further discussion after we have a chance to talk about that.
So let's talk with staff about that. So when do we make a decision that the committee will propose these as committee or this or any other bill? We have to have it in by December 5th, right?
Correct.
So chairs, members, that's correct.
This will be the last time we will be meeting as a committee, right? So don't we need to make a decision today? Or can we make it offline? For a committee bill?
The chairs can submit committee bills without...
Chairs and members, that's correct. It's the decision of the chairs of the committee.
Okay, without...
How to allocate the bill requests that are available to you.
Okay, all right.
But
good.
Generally, of course, it's a courtesy to poll everybody and get their input and all.
Okay, good. That helps clarify. Thank you. Yeah.
With that, I again want to thank everyone who was here today and who participated in the Oregon Elder Abuse Work Group. Thank you for your presentations and for your service on the committee. Whether you were an official governor appointee or whether you just came to be supportive from your particular part of this community, I'm very grateful. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Oregon Elder Abuse Work Group and turn the gavel over to you for further business.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will open up the informational hearing on budget notes and open up the addictions and mental health meeting regarding House Bills 5529 and 5539 and ask Lynn Ray and Mary Claire Buckley to come up. Good morning. Good to see you both. I think to start out with, I will just read those two budget notes as they were in those two bills. The Oregon Health Authority is directed to work with the Psychiatric Secure Review Board to determine the need for community placements for PSRB patients at the Oregon State Hospital for whom hospital level of care is not necessary on an ongoing basis and recommendations for meeting this need. The recommendations should address the potential need for additional 16-bed residential treatment facilities as well as other types of facilities. This report should be prepared for consideration in the February 12th legislative session. And in an additional budget note, the OHA authority is directed to convene a statewide work group to identify the needs of people who are involved in the criminal justice system for minor violations who have mental illness and could be placed in more appropriate settings where they could receive mental health treatment. The group is expected to develop recommendations for methods to divert this group for appropriate and effective mental health care in the community, and the report should be prepared for consideration in the 2013 legislative session. So we know we're a little bit early on these, but we're wanting to know how these things are progressing. So, thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Len Ray, and I am the administrator of Adult Mental Health Services with Addictions and Mental Health.
And for the record, I am Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
What Mary Claire and I are going to do this morning, we're going to break this into a couple of sections for you. I'd like to walk you through the methodology, if you will, of how we decided to put the work group together and what the results of that will be reported by Mary Claire. Mary Claire and I met, and we decided that we needed a work group that really comprised members of the community who have interest with the PSRB and also with residences for members under the board. So what we did was that we put together a group of 16 people, and that group included the executive director of NAMI, Chris Bonoff, the legal affairs director of Disability Rights Oregon, Kathy Wild, the current president of the Oregon Residential Providers Association, Kevin McChesney. We also asked two community mental health directors and three community-based service providers to attend this group. And most importantly, we had two consumers of services who one is currently under the board and one has been under the board, I believe, as well as Mary Claire, two representatives from the state hospital, and two representatives from the Addictions and Mental Health Division. We knew that the work needed to be data-driven, and to do that, we decided that we would look at a snapshot in time of those individuals who are currently in the hospital and have been determined to no longer need hospital level of care, if you will. And in order to do that, we wanted one person to conduct all of the assessments so that there would be continuity in the assessments. And we asked that person to use a tool that Mary Claire and I had researched and believe was a good tool to use in the assessment of the needs of these individuals who are ready to transition. We didn't want the hospital to tell us where someone needed to live, but what we really wanted was specific needs. Tell us what the person needs so that we can look at what supports would be necessary to have them in the community safely. The tool that we looked at was called the Individual Needs for Discharge Assessment, or INDA, and this is a tool that goes with many domains of an individual for assessment. I'm just going to name a few of them just so that you would know. Functional needs of the individual, and that includes in history of deficits in hearing, personal care needs. Wanted to make sure that the medical needs and medication needs, of course, were addressed. Any substance abuse issues. We wanted to make sure that if there were any sex offender or any kind of sex offender treatment or support, we wanted that included as well. Any legal issues having to do with citizenship, commitment status, financial and insurance, family supports was very important to us, as was housing preferences is how this is really listed. And motivation for the individuals who are under the board now to want to live in the community. Some people do, and some people really do not want to go into the community. And then we looked at what the community needs and services are currently, as well as any of the barriers that would be presenting for someone to not be able to leave the hospital. So,
can I stop you right there?
No, please.
Talk to me some about people who don't want to live in the community. You're saying these are people who want to stay in the state hospital?
I can. I can defer to Mary Claire on that as well, but I'll start. There are some individuals under the board who have established their relationships in the hospital, and to go to the community would require different relationships, and also the opportunity in the community may not be in the exact location that someone may want, and so we may have a vacant bed that's in a county that is not nearby where they might want to be. Those are a couple of examples.
You don't need to discuss this today, but at some time I hope you would come to us to talk about, is that a viable option for someone to stay in the hospital? So we don't need to deal with that today, but at some point.
Okay,
do.
I'm happy to. So what we needed to do was we wanted to make sure that the work group was prepared with enough data so that when we met, they would have reviewed all of the data that we wanted to make sure was available. So we provided them the same maps that you have in front of you. We provided them with copies of the findings of the assessments so that everyone at the work group could see the specific needs. We made sure that any kind of information that was secure was removed from the documents before they were handed out. And what that did was it allowed the conversation to be very specific and allowed us to look at, were there cohorts of people having similar needs? Were there a lot of different needs? And it gave us really a snapshot from what the hospital and from what Mary Claire and myself believe would be fairly representative of any point in time, if you will. So the work group met twice, and we went through all of the individual needs. And from the meetings that we had, we asked for preliminary recommendations to be given to us so that we could collect them, we could get them back out to the group and ask them to look to make sure that we didn't miss something that they had wanted to make sure that was in a recommendation to us. And that's the process that we took to review this.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, as Lynn said, Mary Claire Buckley, Psychiatric Security Review Board. After this information was then provided during these meetings, the members had an opportunity to sort of categorize, as Lynn said, to see what cohorts and to look at what we currently have in the community to determine where there may be gaps or what needs might there be to be developed. And as a result of the review, I mean, the categories, we came up with various categories, including medical needs, sex offender, dual diagnosis, substance abuse issues, aggressive behaviors, and figured out of that, you know, 47-person, snapshot, what the various areas of need were.
So I'm going to make clear. So it was 47 patients, clients.
Yes, we're in
this
snapshot on a given day, and we want to.
Okay.
But we believe, as Lynn indicated, that this would be representative of, and you know, most of the time at the hospital, that this was a basic representation of the needs overall on any given day. And based on that, the preliminary recommendations of the group were that, and then basically not only looking at this, but what, as I said, the stock was that we currently have. And so they looked at the number of secure beds that the PSRB currently has in the community, as well as residential treatment facilities and homes and foster homes, which are the licensed facilities in the state. And based on a review of all this data and information, the preliminary recommendations were that there was not any need for additional secure residential treatment facilities at this time. I believe we, you can see from the maps that we've given you that there are 73 secure residential beds at this time for Psychiatric Security Review Board clients. They did, however, see, based on this information, that there was an immediate need for additional medical facilities. Medical facilities. At this point, we have one identified residential treatment home in Multnomah County that is specifically designed for medical. Clearly, the secure facilities all deal with that as well because they have nursing capabilities and nursing staff. But in terms of the residential treatment facilities in the community, or what is considered group homes, we only have one that's specifically identified, and that need is growing in our population, as in most all of the population in Oregon, obviously. And so that was the top recommendation. The third recommendation was that there is a need for the development of additional residential treatment facilities or treatment homes in the proximity to the current secure residential treatment facilities. As you can see from this map, we have secure facilities, a couple in Umatilla, one in Clackamas, one in Marion, Lane County, Deschutes, and Jackson. However, if you also look at the attendant map, in a couple of those places, we do not have residential treatment homes or facilities in those communities, and therefore it makes a step down from secures a difficult process. Because either they only have foster home level of care, which are not 24/7 awake staff, which is often required as a step down from a secure. And so they would recommend that any development at least focus in the areas where the secures do not have a step down at current.
And could I ask you to repeat that again? So we need more secure treatment facilities in Marion?
No, those are where they currently are.
Okay.
What the group was saying is that for residential treatment homes, any that we look to develop should first look to the counties where secure facilities are located, such as Jackson County, Umatilla County, where there are not residential treatment homes or facilities currently existing.
So we need more in Jackson County, Umatilla County,
and Clackamas County. We just repurposed a home, and so hopefully we'll have something there. Deschutes County may also need. We have one RTH there, but because basically the group's focus was that if we had these step downs for secure, then we wouldn't need to develop secure. You could move people more quickly through these higher levels of care if the appropriate step downs were available. They did recognize the need for some type of facility or treatment for sex offenders. That is a cadre that always appears to be problematic. However, the group's recommendation was not to develop a facility solely for sex offenders. Number one, it's very difficult to do, and secondly, may not be the most appropriate modality for those individuals, but rather to find some homes that could provide the supervision and the treatment that these individuals need rather than focusing on the home itself. And finally, there is an immediate need for dedicated respite care facilities throughout the state as part of a continuum of care. And we would, the group suggested that they be created on a regional basis at a minimum, and preferably by county for those counties that serve the greatest number of clients on conditional release. Oftentimes people need a break or a timeout or what have you, and that would greatly help us to avoid hospitalization at the state hospital if we had a place that individuals could go and get that immediate attention and be treated and be able to return to their placement without need for revocation or hospital level of care. I will also mention that the group couldn't resist indicate, although the note talked about facilities, the group did want to indicate an additional need for supported housing and intensive case management options as part of that continuum of care. So those are the preliminary recommendations. The group will again convene to go over those, and then a report will be finalized for the session in February.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions of either of these representatives? Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably either one of you can answer this one, but there's a lot of stuff going on in another committee that affects what you're doing right here, because in healthcare they're doing transformation where they're creating the CCOs, MCOs, and I get concerned because I don't see us reducing anything at the state level, and now we're putting another level of administrative cost, and now we have all these different homes, and all of a sudden you're putting it in a local private company's hands to decide who he's going to disperse the money to or who they're going to use. Can you see any problems where this could affect these homes, the treatment facilities that we have in place? where some of them might go away and they might develop their own, or have you guys looked into this at all or have any concerns like I do about this? This is a pretty loaded question, and I left it wide open for you to drive a truck through.
Representative Widener, members of the committee, what I know we're working on now would be what are some of the measurements and what are some of the outcomes that we're wanting to see both from the CCOs as well as the local mental health authorities. And that is, I would imagine, part and parcel of some of the concerns that we want to make sure. We don't have an answer for that. But we do know that we want to make sure that we are still responsible for the mental health services of the Oregonians that we serve. So we would want to make sure that those concerns are addressed in either a contract or some kind of agreement so that there wouldn't be people left out, if you will, or be at the will of someone. We would want that to be agreed upon in contract between the OHA and the CCOs. It's an unknown for us at this moment, so I would like to give you a better answer, but I don't know what it's going to look like yet.
Representative Frederick.
Hi there. Thank you for doing. I want to take this down a different level. I'm curious. I've become more aware of some of the peer counseling programs that NAMI is involved with, and whether the whole system, rather than just either the residential care treatment homes, but what happens after you get out of that, what kind of support system is set up outside of that. Are you including that within the discussion, or are you unable to because of everything else that you're trying to deal with?
Sure. I'm going to let Mary Claire speak to the first part of that, and then I'll speak to the second.
Co-chairs, Representative Frederick, it's interesting that you said that because the group did want to speak along about that. The first meeting ended up being much a broader discussion than this note, but we tried basically to hone back in on this, you know, the direction of the budget note, and so we didn't include some of those conversations in the work group's recommendations, but clearly that was an issue that was raised and a concern, and clearly peer delivered services are being offered to our clients now. It's becoming even more prevalent, and a lot of our providers are hiring peers, and they are and training actually our clients. A number of our clients have been trained in the peer delivered service and are providing that to their peers in different agencies. So it is happening. It just wasn't the focus of this particular budget note work group.
I was curious about whether it was included within the discussion. That's all. I didn't expect it to be the focus, yeah. So I appreciate that.
If I could respond, the use of peer-delivered services is really fundamental in the health system transformation as well as the addictions and mental health system change that is happening at the same time. We rely on peers for being able to provide services in a better way in some instances than professionals because people have lived the experience, they have been successful, and they're really able to help with individuals who are struggling in a way that is very different than a professional can. So it is a big part of both system changes.
Thank you. I should make it clear I have two family members who are involved with peer counseling programs right now and very, very pleased with the result of what they're dealing with. So,
thank you. Any further questions? Thank you so much, and we look forward to hearing from you again in February 12th. Thanks so much for coming. With that, we will move on to the next budget note regarding children and families and temporary assistance for needy families. House Bill 5030.
Representative Tomei, I should probably just say a little bit about the second budget note that you asked
about.
Oh,
thank you. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. For the record, my name is Len Ray. The second budget note that Representative Tomei read to you, it is a little early to have much going on with that, but I can tell you that I am the lead on that for addictions and mental health, and I am starting to put together a work group, and the work group is going to be a broad-based work group, much like the one that we put together for this particular budget note. I'm going to involve a judge and hopefully a judge who presides over mental health court. I think that would be very helpful. Department of Corrections going to be looking at many of the same representatives that we had on the first work group as well. We're going to need to be gathering data related to the criminal justice system and the mental health population in the criminal justice system, which is going to be a task in and of itself. I'm not sure really how those individuals are identified yet. So once I understand that a bit better, that will be information that will go to the work group, and I'll be able to report back on that at the session.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. How are you working with the Project Clean Slate folks about this? With this,
I'm sorry.
Are you working with the Project Clean Slate folks with?
I don't know what that is. I'm sorry.
Well, you and I should talk.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you so much. And so this is going to be coming up in the 2013 legislative session.
It is.
Would it be too much to ask you to come back during the February session to sort of give us an update on how you are moving on? Or we could do it during later interim meetings. But I would like to hear how things are going. Thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
With that, Aaron. So the budget note that I think Aaron will be addressing will be on House Bill 5030. The Department of Human Services is directed to report to the 2012 legislature on the impact of the restructured Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program and Jobs, Employment, and Training Services on program clients and outcomes. The department is to work with the Employment Department, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, Workforce Oregon, and the Family Services Review Commission and other stakeholders to review the program changes and develop any recommendations for potential program improvements. So thank you for coming today. Hello. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services, and with me this morning is Sochi Esparza. She's our TANF administrator. As the representative referenced, there were clear instructions to the department to be sure that we were working collaboratively with our stakeholder partners around the changes that happened with regard to the TANF program as a result of the budget. Just by way of reminder, and this committee actually participated in the legislation that ultimately codified those changes. Because of the budget environment that we were in, there were significant changes to our job opportunity and basic skills portion of the TANF program. That budget was reduced by 51%. The demand for the budget, if we were meeting it, would have cost the state of Oregon around $122 to $25 million, and the investment the legislature was able to make was only about $50 million. That drastically inhibits our ability to serve the families that need these supports. And just by way of reference, in the month of October, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program served over 90,000 Oregonians. About 60,000 of those Oregonians are children. This committee has been part of a long conversation with the department about TANF. At its core, is really a children's program. To be eligible, you must be a parent with a child, and you must be living at under 40% of the federal poverty level, in other words, in extreme poverty. That means you're earning less than $616 a month if you are a family of three. And the majority, in fact, 95% of individuals who avail themselves of the TANF program, in fact, have zero earnings. And for us, what that really means is that people really do wait until they are nearly homeless to avail themselves of this program as a safety net. It does provide a cash assistance payment. The maximum payment available is around $500 per month, so we support people to live at about 33% of the federal poverty level through the program. But in addition to being a children's program, the primary policy objectives of the program in Oregon for the last many years have really been twofold. One is to ensure that people can go back to work and get off the program. It's an employment program, an employment support program. The other is to ensure that families with children are stable. I've been before you many times talking about the crossover between TANF and child welfare, and when you look at our foster care caseload, we're at about 35-36% of children in foster care and there had been receiving TANF with their families in the previous 2 months. So we have a significant opportunity in the TANF program to stabilize families and prevent child abuse and neglect. At the reduced level, the state is really struggling in order to fulfill those policy objectives, and we're particularly struggling around the issues of employment and the opportunity that we really have with these individuals to get them off of the TANF program. We're seeing the results of that. The TANF program caseload continues to increase. It's been increasing steadily since the economic decline. In fact, when you compare between July 2007 and July 2011, there's been over a 60% increase in Oregon's TANF population. And in our two-parent TANF population, because I think often people imagine that our TANF clients are single mothers, our two-parent TANF population since December of 2007 has increased 350%. I think we view the TANF program currently at its reduced level as a safety net program for very, very vulnerable people. And as we restructured the jobs program to take into consideration the challenging budget environment, we really significantly had to reduce our ability to serve people to get off the program and get back to work, which is one of the reasons we believe the caseload continues to rise, because people continue to come in the door with the downward economy not quite touching all Oregonians yet in terms of the slight uptick. And we are having trouble getting people out the door because we're not able to offer them the kind of employment support services we have in the past. When the program was fully funded following the 2007 legislative session, we had some incredible results. We had people getting back to work at higher rates than we had really ever before in Oregon, and we were doing better in terms of that crossover into child welfare. We had seen the percentage of children who were entering the child welfare system from TANF steadily declining. So we know what to do with TANF. The struggle is to be able to afford it, particularly in the economic downturn that we're currently in. TANF is a federally funded program. It's a block grant. It's a block grant with a lot of strings attached to it, and a lot of requirements around the number of people who are availing themselves of it needing to be working or participating in work activities. As we restructured the greatly reduced jobs program, according to the budget, we had a couple of things in mind. One, we wanted, obviously, with the cash assistance, the legislature decided not to at that time reduce the cash assistance support, which I've already mentioned is not much, in order to maintain our ability to keep people from becoming homeless and allow them to meet their family's basic needs as much as they possibly can at that level. The jobs program, however, at that reduced level was not able to continue to be as comprehensive as it had been. So we took a program that at one point had employment training, family stability, and other options around life skills training, supports for addiction and recovery. We estimate that nearly 70% of the adults that are availing themselves of TANF services are struggling with some kind of disability that impedes their ability to go back to work easily, a learning disability, for example, or they're in recovery. And so often this program has provided some really necessary support to people to be able to manage those issues, become employable, and then work with employers to get them into employment. Now we're forced really to focus on three things: work experience, subsidized employment, and job search. And we've significantly reduced the support services to families that go along with that, such as childcare and transportation. It's difficult to be a parent and be expected to participate in activities if you can't afford to have your children safely cared for, and you can't afford to pay for the transportation that you need to actually get to the job site or the training site that we're asking you to go to. So we've had to greatly limit our support services for families. And that's caused some challenge for many of our families, particularly those who are on TANF, are in recovery programs, and we've been partnering significantly with our partners in addiction and recovery and mental health services to try and ensure as best possible, not through the TANF budget, but through other means, that the children of parents who are in those programs are being cared for and supported so that their parents can recover from their addiction. The Budget Note Workgroup has been focusing on what are the consequences of all of this, and how can we inform policymakers about what all of this has meant in real life for real families and in our communities. The Budget Note Workgroup includes TANF client advocacy representatives, including the Family Services Review Commission, which is our standing advisory body in the department around the TANF and other self-sufficiency programs. The TANF Alliance is part of the workgroup. Jobs contracted providers, representatives from the Oregon Employment Department and community colleges and workforce development, as well as individuals from the department. They've been meeting since the month of August. Like those who have gone before, I just want to thank the people in this room who are part of those conversations. They've been very robust. They meet very regularly. They've been extremely helpful to the agency to ensure that we're gathering the appropriate data. One of the challenges I know the legislature and the department has struggled with in the past when we make significant changes due to budget reductions from programs is to really be able to evaluate what was the impact of those changes and to be able to come back and have a thoughtful conversation about that. This group, because of the myriad of perspective it brings, is helping us cull through all of our data, pick the most salient data points to bring back to you. They're also sponsoring, and this is very important, a survey to ensure that individuals who avail themselves of TANF services, including families who've accessed services, DHS staff, DHS contracted providers, community service providers, and even people who know a family receiving TANF, have the opportunity to inform the state about their experience in terms of the program reductions. That survey is closing this week. We've had over 500 people already respond to it, so we're looking forward to being able to analyze that information, bring it back to you all so you can understand what it's meant for individuals to have this experience.
Aaron, I think we have a question here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How are they responding? Is this, did you send this out? Do we do casework on this, or is it computer? How does that work?
Chair Gilliam and members of the committee, my name is Sochi Esparza. I'm the TANF Program Manager at the Department of Human Services. The survey is available online, but we're also offering other opportunities. There are focus groups that are being put together the month of November, and one took place last month with community partners to offer different opportunities or different ways of sharing information.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So that's a pretty high percentage of respondents given the number. Am I right so far?
Well, we are pleased, Co-Chair Gilliam, we are pleased that the respondents so far have been from all of the five different categories, and they are representative of the racial and ethnicities of our community. And I think 500 is a good number. Our caseload, though, is much higher than that. I think given that the timing and given the fact that it is an online survey, we are pleased that so many people have already filled it out.
Thank you for that.
And that, having it be an online survey, I could imagine that a lot of these people would not have access to a computer, so it would be sort of self-selected in a way. So I'm glad to hear that you're having focus groups, because it seems to me you'd get more in-depth response there. And I would, maybe it would, in the February session, or maybe in one of the meetings, committee meetings after that, you could bring in some people from a focus group to sort of give us firsthand information about what this, all of this is meaning to them and how it's affecting their lives. That would be helpful. Thank you.
Co-chairs, we will do that. I appreciate the offer and the opportunity. A couple of initial findings that the group has made about what's happening as a result of the program reductions. Approximately 325 jobs, contractor, private sector jobs have been lost as a result of these budget reductions. We, as you know, in the department, the vast majority, over 90% of our resource goes out in the form of benefits and or contracts to the provider community, and that's also the case in TANF. Other than the benefit of the amount, we do have staff who provide eligibility and case management service, but the vast majority of that 51% reduction most impacted our jobs contract providers. And so we've been making a very deliberate effort to ensure you're aware of the cascade of job loss associated with this particular set of budget reductions.
Actually, may I?
Yes, Representative.
Because you just kind of prompted something there, Aaron. With that happening, also in reverse, a lot of the people are in the situation they're in because of the economy. Are you noticing that's probably why your caseload is so high with the downturn in the economy?
Co-chairs, Representative Widener. Yeah, I would say that we definitely believe that the downturn in the economy and the job loss is the primary driver for the TANF caseload increase. I think also when you look at the poverty statistics in Oregon and really nationally, people who were just on the edge of living at levels of extreme poverty, which is, again, this particular program, are unfortunately now falling over that edge at higher rates. And so it's not just that the number of people in poverty have increased since the downturn, but it's also that the number of people and children in particular living in extreme poverty is going up at really high rates.
So let me follow. So it'd probably be pretty safe to say until we start creating some private sector jobs, we're going to start keep seeing this downward spiral continue with your department.
Co-chairs, Representative, I think it's definitely true that our department does, you know, the design of our programs is to be able to support people who are not able to help themselves and then get them back on their feet. And I think one of the dilemmas around this particular program that is being very acutely felt in communities and by our agency is that we've really hamstrung our ability to do that second thing, which is to get people back on their feet, because we're so limited in our ability to get people back to work. And that's for two reasons. Part of it is the employment picture that Oregon is facing, and part of it is also that we don't have adequate resources to equip people to even take advantage of jobs as they become available. We have seen our caseloads going up, and you can see directly the trend line start to go up a little bit before, but really when the recession was officially declared, we already were seeing increases, and they've just steadily increased since then. And I think that's to be expected given the business that we're in. It's also been our history in the past that as the economy at large recovers, there's a lag between also our caseloads beginning to decline because of the people who are on them having trouble being able to avail themselves fully of the economic recovery.
So when we're missing the supportive services like employment-related daycare and transportation services, these folks aren't able to take advantage of jobs that they would otherwise be able to take, which would affect both the adults who aren't able to work, and it affects, obviously, the children, and it affects the community. If they were able to work, they could bring in income, and it affects their neighborhood, right?
Co-chair, to me, that's correct.
I may, because one more was kind of prompted there.
Sure.
One of the problems I've seen with different departments and everything, if you don't use your money, you lose it. In your department, to me, when times are good, we should be looking at ways to save money to help people when times get bad. Is there anything like that that you see that we could do? Because you have more revenue when more people are working and you have less demand for the services. Now, when demand's high, you don't have the revenue there because you're required to spend it. Would there be any way that you would see a benefit to set up like a savings account, like your own rainy day fund for your department or for the TANF program to help people when times get bad?
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, we would strongly support that. And at one point, the department and the Ways and Means Committee had such an arrangement, and we were beginning to bank a little bit of resource. It wasn't a lot. I think at the point we ended up needing to spend it, it was about $10 million for, at that point in time, the entirety of DHS and the Oregon Health Authority, which is about a $16 billion budget. So we were beginning that conversation, and your logic is exactly correct, that when things are better, actually, our services are less in demand. If we were a private sector company, the demand, I mean, some people have reflected that, we would be celebrating the increase in the demand for our services. We're on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. We celebrate when there's less demand. And it's true, I think, the needs that we have when there is the significant decline that we are seeing in the economy, they skyrocket. And then they go, I mean, I think it's both the impact and also the duration.
I mean, Madam Chair.
Oliver?
I think this is something this committee should be addressing for the department and the agency, because we need to get a safety net or money put in place to help people when times are bad, because we're too late this time, but we do know recessions are going to happen again. I mean, it's over the U.S. history, and we should look at setting something up in place. When things turn around, we can start taking money and putting it into a savings account for the department to help people when times are bad.
That's just the department, I think, but for all state services, I think we need a rainy day fund.
Well, we have the rainy day fund, but nobody wants to step up and put the money into it.
Yeah.
I mean, when times were good, they didn't put a dime into it. So.
Okay, any other questions? Go ahead.
I think we've covered really what the budget work group is focused on, and we do look forward to coming back and presenting a full report to really take you from the pre-TANF experience all the way to the post-TANF and employment-related daycare experience, and what's really happening along that continuum, and then also be able to draw the correlation around our child welfare services so that you can really see what's happened over this period of time and how some of the decisions that we're having to make as a state, which I fully appreciate are incredibly difficult, are impacting kids and families in our communities. And we'll also follow up on your request to have TANF recipients and community members here to be able to give you a firsthand account of what that looks like for them.
That would be great. Thank you very much. All right, Erin, I think we're going to keep you. Are we keeping you for the next presentation? Or is that?
Yes.
Yes,
ma'am.
You and Patricia Baxter. So in this budget note, again, it was in House Bill 5030, Oregon has a duty to enhance and preserve a long-term care system prepared to address the needs of low-income seniors and people with physical disabilities, provide maximum service delivery, and make the best use of public funds as Oregon population ages. The governor shall convene key stakeholders, including representatives from the Department of Human Services, to study and recommend the best mix of services and supports, including supports to caregivers, to be available in every Oregon community that will keep Oregon seniors and people with disabilities as independent as possible, healthy, and safe. Specific plans and recommended steps to best blend state and federal resources with private pay to assure access to high-quality care and supports for individuals, families, and caregivers. And plans and recommended steps to better align state and local administrative structures, identify cost efficiencies, and to create incentives to assure consistent, efficient, effective service delivery and high-quality service outcomes. The work group shall seek broad input from all stakeholder groups before submitting recommendations to the appropriate legislative committee by January 12th. And we're just wanting to catch up a little bit with what has been done since the session ended, and we'll hear from you again in January. Thank you so much for coming.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, for the record, Erin Kelly Seal, and with me is Tricia Baxter. She's our Chief Operating Officer for programs around aging and disability services, as well as developmental disabilities. She's also actively engaged with me, and we'll touch on this. She's co-chairing one of the external work groups for the health systems transformation effort, which is relating to this budget note in part. As you could hear or read if you happen to be reading the budget notes. This was a very comprehensive budget note that the department was asked to support, and it was unique in that it charged the governor to actually appoint members of these working groups. Really, I think the scope and the breadth really speaks to the challenging budget climate, again, that we're facing in long-term care. And when I say long-term care, I'm really speaking about the Medicaid support services specifically, and their service delivery for both seniors, people with disabilities, and also in our long-term care system under our home and community-based services is our entire developmental disabilities population as well. So we have services that span all of those different population groups. And this particular budget note really was focusing on our aging and disability service delivery system and opportunities to do a couple of things. One was looking at the demographic changes. I think that the Ways and Means Committee was hopeful that the department and stakeholders and our partner agencies would come back to you all with some policy recommendations about opportunity to bend the cost curve in terms of delaying entry into Medicaid long-term care and or reducing the cost of long-term care services once an individual requires them. So really getting ahead on a preventive side and looking at what can we be doing differently in order to support people to be as financially independent for as long as possible. I think in general, and it was repeated today in the forecast conversation, people know that our population is aging, we're all aging, but our baby boomers are about to really be entering into the age with in which we see them qualifying for Medicare, Medicaid, and Medicaid long-term care services at higher rates, and also our aging population is living longer, so the percentage of those who are 85 and older in Oregon is growing. It's putting acute pressure on our system, and as you know, I think, our long-term care system here in Oregon is nationally renowned. We only serve about 18% of our population in nursing facilities, and our nursing facilities and institutional settings are really changing their business model to be more about short lengths of stay and hospital transition than they are about long lengths of stay. We've really prioritized in the state serving people independently in their own homes. And so we've saved the state quite a bit of money these last three decades with that policy approach. And when I go and talk with other states, they're envious. They're actually rebalancing their systems to look more like Oregon's and extract savings as they do that and as they transition their nursing facilities to be a smaller percentage of service. The irony of all of this is that from a federal perspective, nursing facility care is a federal mandate. And so the most expensive, costly care, which usually is the least preferred by individuals who require these services, except when it's clinically appropriate and they need a different kind of care. And we value our nursing facility partnerships as part of our larger continuum, and we really need them in our communities. But in general, people would like to be able to be home if they can, and they'd like to be living as financially independently as they possibly can. But what we're learning, and what this particular budget note work group is asking us to focus on if you look just at subsection one, is we think there are some things that the state could do and put in place in terms of policy to help people be more independent for longer and hopefully, as I say, both meet their preferential needs, meet their care needs, and also maybe in the end save the state what is projected to be an increasing cost over time as we see the demand for service increasing. So when approaching this budget note, it's obviously large in scope. What the governor decided to do was to actually split the groups into two. He asked one group that he appointed to really focus on that issue around prevention, early intervention, and really helping people to be as financially independent as possible. And he asked a second group, which I'll go into more detail about, to focus on the last two parts of the budget note, which really focus on cost and service delivery, administration, and efficiency. The first group is comprised of governor appointees representing the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, the Oregon Disability Commission, our AAA service delivery partnerships, as well as our state independent living centers. they're focusing on opportunities, as I said, to delay entry or avoid entry into Medicaid long-term care. And the way they're going about this work is they're actually identifying areas of risk that can contribute to an individual's loss of personal or financial independence and therefore lead them into a place where they actually do qualify for Medicaid long-term care. So they're focusing on things like financial risk. So how do we support people to make better informed financial planning decisions around their own long-term care needs so perhaps they can support themselves or their family members for a longer period of time without the need of the state or public dollar to contribute that to that support. They're looking at issues around social isolation and safety. So all of the work we just were talking about earlier this morning around abuse to elders or people with disabilities, sometimes that can be a precipitating event that can contribute to someone needing to access long-term care services. And so we're looking at ways to be able to take those recommendations that already have been made and look at them through this lens and identify opportunities to connect the safety of seniors and vulnerable adults to the prevention of the need for long-term care. And we're looking at health and behavioral health risks. Really, the group's taking a very public health approach, looking to identify risks and identify opportunities for earlier intervention in people's lives. There's also been a wealth of work done on this already, and the group is taking all the previous existing reports. They've actually organized them under these various risk categories. They're identifying gaps, and they're prioritizing recommendations, looking, of course, first at things that don't cost any money, and then kind of from there looking at things that can have the greatest impact for the greatest and have the greatest value. In the end, the conversation Representative Widener was bringing up, I think, is one this group would like to discuss. If we can create a model by which we're demonstrating that we're actually saving the state dollars in long-term care, would there be a reinvestment strategy that could be looked at by the legislature so there could be incentives and rewards for achieving savings, doing the right thing, and then actually reinvesting in those kinds of prevention, early intervention activities that contribute to the health and well-being of our aging and disability population. The second work group also Governor appointed is actually a subgroup of the Medicare-Medicaid Integration of Care and Services work group that the Governor appointed under Health Systems Transformation. And that work group is really looking, the first work group, which is very big, it's I think over 40 people, are really looking at the acute care side of Medicare and Medicaid and asking questions about integration and coordination. This particular subgroup has been asked by the Governor to focus on long-term care delivery system implications for CCO enrollment for individuals who are actually triply eligible. So that means they're accessing long-term care services under our aging and disability programs, and they're also eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. As you know, House Bill 3650 excluded long-term care services and budget from CCO integration efforts. However, legislators and stakeholders in the health and long-term care systems remain concerned about a couple of things. Yes. First and foremost, we have a long-term care system that has demonstrated an ability to deliver high-quality results at the lowest cost possible because of the priority placed on in-home and community-based care. We don't want that to change. We want to continue to be able to offer people who need Medicaid long-term care services a person-centered approach to care, an approach that supports people in the setting of their choice, but obviously, as we said, we've had great success with people being in their own homes and in the community. And we want to avoid cost shift going either direction as this conversation about the potential for health transformation is underway. So we've identified opportunities where without this conversation happening, we're concerned on the long-term care side, there could be incentives for coordinated care organizations to actually move people into nursing facility settings as opposed to a less restrictive environment where maybe their clinical needs could be met. We've also identified opportunities for the long-term care system to perhaps access less hospital or emergency department settings, which are high cost to the healthcare system, and instead allow people to be treated in their own home or treated by a physician, which would cost the health system less. So this particular subgroup is looking through the lens of the long-term care system at the potential and the conversations that are happening on the health transformation side, and then answering the questions of the budget note. How do we ensure that we're efficiently and effectively organizing our delivery system and our coordination between the delivery systems, and how do we ensure that we're not cost-shifting, and how do we promote the highest quality care that we can using our federal and state dollars? So the budget note, as I said, is very vast. It's really focusing on those two areas of work primarily. Each of the groups has met just a couple of times. They'll be meeting through December and then producing a report in January, much like these other reports, and coming back to the legislature, hopefully to provide you with some good information as you're making decisions in February. I know February will be dominated by the budget discussion, but I know also you expect to be having some conversations about health transformation as well. And there are implications for the system around that discussion that I think could positively, where some policy could positively impact our services.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yes.
If I may, on this, because you touched on an issue that I'm very concerned with when I saw them wanting to commingle Medicare and Medicaid. Right now, our seniors can be seen, and our Medicaid patients are having to go to the emergency room because doctors won't see them because we don't reimburse enough. And that's the thing I worry about when they start commingling those. If they basically reduce reimbursement rates on Medicare to doctors, now our seniors are going to end up having to go to emergency rooms as well. So this is something our seniors need to be concerned with and watching very closely. I think what happens with the CCOs and MCOs, because the other thing we have to look at is they're going to be putting another 30% of basically just labor in the middle of having to deal with billing and collecting and taking care of all these doctors. So your administrative costs are going to be there, and we need to make sure we reduce administrative costs at the state level if we're going to put the burden on these MCOs and CCOs. Otherwise, it's more money getting ate up, less money to serve the patients that we have. And I'm worried our seniors could get thrown under the bus with this. So I'm glad that you're looking at it, and I hope you continue to watch it very closely, because we'll be voting on this stuff in February.
Yes, Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, you're really touching on a critical issue, and in the transformation question, leaving the long-term care, theoretically leaving long-term care out of the CCO in terms of the cost of the nursing home, but requiring the CCOs to provide medical care services in the home really provides all kinds of crazy incentives, which you raised. I think it's really important that we keep an eye on those incentives, because there are ways to provide healthcare services, medical care services, in the long-term care institutions, both the nursing homes and others, that, I mean, we have some real models, but it's mostly not done very well. And I had an instance with a relative who was told to come and get her mother, who had dementia and had gotten confused, come and get her mother and take her mother to an urgent care center. And it was just made no sense whatsoever. But I'm afraid that's the kind of stuff we're going to get. So what you're doing is God's work in this.
Indeed. Indeed.
Madam Chair, if I may have one direct question that one of you might be able to answer. The Fed, right now we get less in reimbursement rates because we do the in-home care from the federal government. Is that correct? Because they'll reimburse for nursing homes, but they don't do it for the in-home care, or are we okay on that?
Let me take that. Sure.
Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei and Representative Widener. I think what you're, because Aaron mentioned that Medicaid only requires nursing facility care, doesn't mean that they don't support community-based care as well. We get the same match rate wherever the level of care is provided. However, if we look to reduce our budget, the only thing we're mandated to keep by CMS is the nursing facility care. So it becomes a challenge as we look to cut budgets, and we're limited, and the highest cost thing has to remain. But we do get the Medicaid share for facility or community-based services as well as facilities. Medicare itself does not pay for long-term care. Medicaid does.
I'm sorry, you didn't identify yourself.
I'm sorry.
For the record,
did you? Yeah,
thank you.
Tricia Baxter, Chief Operating Officer with Seniors and People with Disabilities at the Department.
Okay. And could you identify CMS, please?
Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services.
At the federal.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Since, so with that there, because they do it at the highest level, if we called it in-home nursing care services or nursing home services, in-home nursing home services, would we be able to include those in the nursing home category? I'm just trying to think of a creative way to keep our match up, since it seems like we're one of the leaders on this and other states are receiving a lot more on the match side, and we kind of get penalized a little bit for doing things right.
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, I appreciate your creativity. You know, what's interesting about this is that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services just put out some regulations where they're becoming very prescriptive about what they consider to be home and community-based care. And those prescriptions could have very negative consequences for Oregon. And we really created this whole system and its design back in the 80s when we reformed our long-term care system. And so obviously we and the stakeholders have been partnering on giving CMS what we believe to be some very valuable feedback about how disruptive their current perspective is and how out of touch it is with what the full continuum of a system needs to look like. We are looking at some creative waiver strategies. We've been having conversations, not necessarily under the assignment of the budget note, but with our stakeholder partners about, right now Oregon has 6 waivers. We have multiple waivers and multiple state plan amendments. And as we've been talking with national consultants, they've actually been suggesting to Oregon that we maybe consider having one large umbrella waiver and that we really push CMS on some of these very issues that you're talking about. I mean, I think right now our waiver does what you're saying. I think it says that we want to be able to provide these services in people's homes and in their communities wherever possible. We're not getting any indication that Congress, which is, I believe, the entity that would need to act, would actually consider changing the nursing facility mandate. But we are getting indications that there is a policy understanding that having this full continuum is really important, and that Oregon may be able to go to that next level with our federal partnership around our waiver strategy for long-term care and do things like, so they just created a new waiver option for in-home care. And ostensibly, Oregon was one of the models that they looked at to create this waiver option, and yet it actually does less than Oregon's in-home program currently does. But it offers an enhanced match rate. And so Oregon's currently struggling with how do we shoulder the administrative burden of yet one more waiver, continue serving everyone we're still serving, and part of our challenge with the budget with long-term care is we're literally looking under every rock for every additional dollar. So if they're giving enhanced match for in-home services, how do we take advantage of that, but also not compromise the in-home program we currently have that's working so effectively? That's a real challenge. And so, you know, one of the ideas is go after a larger waiver and kind of request the enhanced match for our population without the administrative burden that goes along with this carve-out new waiver option they've created that doesn't fit our program. So we're wrestling with those questions, and we really feel like it's important to wrestle with them, keeping in mind the picture of health systems transformation so that our system is moving forward in a way that actually benefits the individuals that we're serving currently, and we don't have unintended consequences from the two coming together.
Thank you, Erin. Any further questions? All right. Thank you, ladies, both very much. And we look forward to hearing from you in February 12th. Thank you. And with that, I think, Representative Thompson, we're going to hear about the court-appointed special advocate task force.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I did give Senator Boquist's office a heads up. I checked in the hallway for Judge yesterday and didn't see her there. So.
Well, it appears that we have a small panel today. Judge Easterday, I understand, is in court this morning.
Small but powerful.
Absolutely. And I have no idea where Senator Boquist is. He planned to be here, but he's obviously not at the moment. So if he comes in behind me, you know, he'll be here. This task force was...
Did you identify yourself?
Oh, Jim Thompson, State Representative, House District 23.
Oh, why, that's where I know you.
Remember
from.
That, yeah. Right. But, this task force was charged with the, turns out, more difficult task of finding a new home for the court-appointed children's advocacy program. History-wise, that's been housed for some time in the Commission on Children and Families. There was a Blue Ribbon report several years ago in which they had decided at that time it was no longer a good fit and needed to be transferred somewhere else. In the succeeding period, we have done in the Commission on Children and Families, which expedited the need to find a new home for the CASA program. The program is a very cost-effective, supportive program for foster children. Our problem in dealing with it is it has been perennially underfunded and probably needs some growth. We have a lot more foster kids needing CASA support than what we have in terms of CASA volunteers. It's greatly cost-effective because the people are highly trained volunteers working under the jurisdiction of the court, and it's done some really great work. One of the issues that comes up in trying to find a new home for them is getting to fit within some system, but realizing that there is a natural tension between CASA workers and foster care counselors or caseworkers. And oftentimes they're pitted against each other in court, so it's adversarial at times. So it's finding that right balance. We've looked at a number of agencies who took a look at the budget and said, get out of here. You know, we're not that crazy. You know, that situation is made more difficult in the finding that the Commission on Children and Families obviously absorbed a lot of the cost administration expense across other things. So there isn't just an administrative budget we can pick up and transfer. Because it was being absorbed in, so we are left then with the money that went directly to the county CASA programs, and about $50,000 that comes from the federal CASA program as the budget. So probably in the budgeting arrangement, we're going to have to cut the CASA support to counties, at least temporarily, to generate the funds to handle administrative load wherever we place it. So that's not that that's an unusual circumstance with our budget situation right now, but it's unfortunate because we're going to be making a bad situation worse for a period of time. The two options that seem most real right now, and we'll be resolving that very soon, are the Governor's Commission on Volunteers, which would be a reasonable fit. The problem with that is it's a very small commission, works totally with federal money. It's not funded by the state. And this appears to effectively double their workload. So it's a huge increase to that particular commission. They're willing to do it. In this particular instance, I'm not sure willing is a word we can use anywhere, but they're not objecting strongly to doing it, and we're exploring that option. The other option in working with the Chief Justice is to transfer it into judicial. They're not quite ready to do that yet, but that may be expedited. And Chief Justice Dominguez has proposed a plan where we would take two other functions of juvenile court and combine them together into a, for lack of a better word, a sub-agency dealing with juvenile justice. And we're going to have an arm wrestling contest later today because I need to convince him that we need to do that sooner than another year or two out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all kind of things can happen if we play nice. Anyway, so that's basically where we are. Senator Boquist has done a lot of work on this last option and was supposed to be here this morning to discuss it in more detail, but it's those are the two options we're dealing with at the moment. We anticipate we will have a bill ready for 2012 because of the issue with placing them budget-wise, because they're on a temporary situation right now. Children and families will go away, and we need to do something about the budget for the last half of this biennium as to where it's, what it is and where it's going to be put. That's the first problem. Second problem is how we get the long-term organization into place. So my preferred fix would be to ask for several million dollars in funding, which of course would be a giant waste of time at this juncture.
Yes, it would.
The other option is to figure out some way to charge the thing off to the Senate, because they're
all those in favor, Madam Chair. Yeah.
And they need some wins. So, Senator Boquist, thank you for joining us. We were just going to discuss in depth the judicial option, which you've been working with mostly. So,
have you covered the judicial?
No, I just introduced it as the most viable right now. So, please.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, Senator Boquist, I was the lone no vote on the CASA task force bill in the Senate, so therefore the presiding officer appointed me to be on the committee. And it's been a very interesting and lively discussion about, you know, the organization and structure. Judge Easterday was elected as the chair. It's a pretty diverse group, and as I say, there has been some lively discussions, and in showing in the lead that the House has provided, everything is electronic, so we're all battering back and forth between each other with huge data files and things like that. So we're making progress. The committee has kind of come down to realization there's kind of three options we see. I'll review them very quickly. One option is do nothing, I suppose. And the do nothing option is that, you know, technically we'll probably default to the Early Learning Council. So that's kind of out there. I don't really think anybody in the committee and the work group task force sees that. The second one that we've kind of come upon is the Committee for Volunteer Action and Services, which has the volunteer slice, but it really doesn't have the connection to the judiciary slice. And if you all know, I think you do because you dealt with this issue, that, you know, the CASA volunteer program really falls under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court in each of the 36 counties. So you've got 36 different versions out there. So, and then, you know, the Chief Justice has agreed to provide some mentoring if we go that direction. And then the third option that's kind of we're still discussing in the committee is that since it does fall under the judiciary and their enabling language is under the 36 county juvenile courts, is there some sort of mechanism to get it into there, whether that be a short-term mechanism of the existing commission extends the contracts. You all know we work on a biennium basis, but their contracts are on an annual basis, so they do two sets of contracts with each county every biennium, which really doesn't make any sense because we fund them on a biennium basis. And then the Chief Justice has kind of come back with a couple of ideas about consolidating and saving money and has identified some revenue, potential revenue sources. The number they use, which I don't think they can be held to, is about $200,000 in revenue sources to kind of administer the program somewhere a year out or 2 years out. And that's sort of where we are. How exactly it goes, as we all know, the task force makes a recommendation, and then it comes to you folks. I think the one challenge on the volunteer action and services side, initially it looked like a very good fit, is that they don't have any structure, which means they've actually thrown a number of $100,000, $125,000 out that it would take to do that. And since we have no, at least on the Senate side, we have no discretionary funding, we know that you're going to have to take it out of HIDE. And so the best thing to do is find a mechanism that takes the least amount out of HIDE in the program until it starts developing and going forward. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. I apologize. Judge Easterday is in court today. She intended to be here. She's not here. I do hope that the task force will kind of, at least on the Senate side, I don't know, on Representative Thompson's side, once we kind of come to kind of a more solidified position, then I'm going to email all 30 senators and say, okay, I'm looking for your input here before we get to the February session. This is kind of the direction we're going. What do you think? I'd be happy to entertain.
Senator, I'm curious why you stated that going into the governor's Early Learning Council was not a preferred alternative. Could you talk some about that?
Co-Chair Graham, Co-Chair Tomei, our understanding from the Early Learning Council is it's going to be focusing on the exactly that, the early end, the first, you know, up to ages 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in that category. And, of course, the CASA takes the whole broad range of the juvenile program. So it's a little bit of a slight fit. The second thing that's out there is, of course, it isn't a plan. So, therefore, it would be, I guess you could say, an additional duty. It's by default. There just isn't any place else for it to go. And as you know, when everybody's carving up resources and on the 30th day of June of next year, suddenly they say, oh, CASA's got to go someplace. I think we all know with our experience here what's going to happen.
So how can we help you folks? How can this committee help you?
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, what I'm struggling with as the senator is to figure out why our side didn't agree with you guys last time. So that's what I could use is any insight any of you have that happened in the discussions in the main session of, you know, there was kind of a plan going forward. It almost looks like we're going to default to the same plan you all came to a conclusion with and then sent it down to Ways and Means, but for some reason it didn't happen. I don't think I need to tell any of you task forces aren't one of those things that the legislature sets up very often because there was an agreement. And I'm still literally struggling. That's why I made mention, Madam Co-Chair, that I'm going to send an email out to all 30 members and basically say, speak now or forever hold your peace, because you put us into this. We stopped it, I think, literally on our side for some reason. Now, here's the plan going forward. We need to know now before we get to February, or else we will go to the default position.
One of the sticking points, frankly, is the budget, because we had even discussed at one time turning the whole thing over to the state CASA Directors Network. They have the same problem. They're 20-some, maybe 30 counties represented by county CASA directors. They work for different people. In Polk County, they report to the district attorney. That's the only county that has that model. They have an association-type structure, but they have no physical being. There's no office, there's no staff, and to set up that kind of an administrative structure to handle a couple million-dollar budget would likewise eat a big chunk of their budget up, and they have no capacity to do that. Probably less capacity than if we went through the judicial route.
So Madam Chair, I wonder, hearing Senator Boquist, Representative Senator Boquist's concern, I wonder if it's something we took up as maybe a joint committee, because it is kind of odd that it should have screamed out of the Senate, because it came out of here unanimous, if I remember correctly, out of our committee, and kind of got held up there.
Isn't this what we have as a joint committee? How would that be different?
Co-Chair, Representative Tomei, Co-Chair, Representative Gilliam, in the task force, we have the House member, and with the task force that was created, and then on our side, myself. It left here and went downstairs to the Ways and Means, and it's in the Ways and Means process down there that it turned into a task force. So I'm not sure what we do joint. I think that the challenge is going to be is going early to members of the Senate, probably more so than members of the House, and laying out what the plan is we think we're going to propose and getting feedback. And I think, as you all know, then it's a little bit easier when we get to, you know, the second week of February and saying, hey, we need to have a plan here. Here's the plan. We told you what the plan was 6 weeks ago. You didn't have a problem with the plan 6 weeks ago, so now what do we do to go next? The budget portion of it, which is taking it overwhelming, because we all realize what the fiscal reality is. There's a lot of people that like to say we need more structure, we need more standardization, so on and so forth like that. But you got to have somebody in charge of this thing to do that. The network, the Oregon CASA network, at some point could be that entity. However, as you know, we don't fund money directly to 501(c)s. They must go through some other agency first. And I think if we have the opportunity, and we as the legislative body, and what I intend to propose to the other members after discussions yesterday with the judiciary branch again, is you know, we get the existing commission to extend those contracts now, not later, because all they are is a reprint of the same contract last year, and get the administrative functions down by the outgoing commission, and then that will provide enough time maybe in the judiciary side for them to get their side up and running. And it'll also provide in the end one focal point in the end to go say, we have a problem, we need to fix this. At that point, you know, when I can figure out, and to Representative Widener's deal, when I can figure out who in the Senate is is the bump in the log, I'll be more than happy to ask you to call them, too.
I've been appointed to several sensitive review committees regarding situations in children and families, especially regarding foster care or all kinds of issues. But also Senator Monis Anderson and Senator Cruz have been appointed to those also. And so we've seen in these sensitive review committees how important the CASAs are. So I would think if you maybe could meet with them to get some support on their side to help you work through this, because I think this committee is willing to do whatever you ask of us. Do you need some legislation for us to be looking at in 2012?
We're holding a bill, so that's good, yeah.
Okay.
And I think we will have to have legislation in 2012 to clarify where we're going.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, I think we're absolutely going to have to. The way it sits right now is it does sit in statute. It's strange. It sits under, the program sits under, at the state level, under community, on the Commission of Family and Children, but yet the enabling language is over on the judiciary side under the juvenile court, and it's bifurcated to start with right now. And, you know, for us to take any independent action is just not going to work. I unfortunately think that there will be winners and losers, as there are in bureaucracies in the state, and so some people will not be exactly happy with how we go about doing it. But I think we're going to have to put enabling language in there to make that transition happen, or it will be done by executive order on the 30th day of June, and that's the last thing I think any of us want to happen, because it leaves a lot of vulnerable kids out there if we do it that way.
Yeah,
and it's not a trivial matter either. I've for several years have looked into child abuse cases involving foster children. In every case I've looked at where there was abuse, there was not a CASA.
Yeah.
And we need more of them. They provide a really important service. As a volunteer, there's no cost to the state other than the administrative section to hold the thing together. And we need twice as many volunteers, which begs to having a better organization to coordinate the procurement and training of those volunteers. So we need to move it forward. It's something that's extremely important. And this isn't the time to talk about budget.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative, do you concur with the Senator's sort of outline of what that legislative action might be?
Yeah.
And that should be in the bill that we're hopefully going to have as a committee bill.
Right. That's what I think we're aimed at right now. And
Co-Chairs, members of the committee, just for clarification, it doesn't, whether it goes to the judiciary or whether it goes to volunteer action and services, there's a judge right there. It wouldn't matter. We're still going to have some sort of piece of legislation because it is bifurcated now, and it is under the Commission on Family and Children on that side right now. And since that commission is going away in some form on June 30th, we have to have some piece of legislation that even would enable the governor outside of an executive order to do it. And with that, I'm going to...
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Greenland.
Thank you. I just heard that the Commission on Family Commissions, whatever it is, the Joint Committee, has several resolutions, and one of which involves the early childhood education, which Representative Thompson points out is aimed at young children, but their resolution about several of their programs suggests that commission ought to take up responsibility for all school-age kids, pre-K to 12, and apparently you guys have rejected that move for this project, which is, as you point out, one of their projects. I think their argument is it ought to go to that commission, which ought to be responsible for all school-age kids. Am I missing something in that transition?
Yeah. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Greenlick. What we have been able to glean from the executive branch, and you guys will be happy to take on the executive branch, is that the early learning council is going to be just in those lower ages. And I actually heard that out of the chief executive of the state's mouth in the last 24 hours. So we're struggling ourselves, as I pointed out to you. We're trying to figure out what happened, how to get to where it is, so on and so forth.
And who's to take care of the other kids?
Well, I think you could ask the governor that question, and I suppose he owes us a report on, I think, December 15th of the new investment board to tell us how he plans on structuring that. But I'm just telling you what we're being, what we're hearing and what we're being told. So,
thank you, another issue that we can't get around is really a court function. It's not an education function so much as a lot of what the governor is trying to do is to tie everything together for a seamless educational program all through the system. And this is beyond that, and not the best fit for that reason.
Judge, thank you so much for coming today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. I'm sorry I didn't realize it was going to start right at 10:30. I feel bad that I missed some of what was said, and I don't know what was said.
Could you just introduce yourself?
My name's Judge Cynthia Easterday. I'm from McMinnville. And would you like me to kind of give you an update of what we've done the last three meetings? Because we've actually met half a day, three different times, and I think we've actually made some really good progress. But if the senator and representative have already done that.
I've got these gentlemen about whether or not they'd like you to.
Great. Okay, so we actually started off by October 26th, November 3rd, November 14th. We're going to meet November 28th. And I feel like we've made some really good progress. We've spent a lot of the time just educating ourselves because we have a lot of, there's nine of us, and we come from different backgrounds and different levels of experience in the legislative process. But a lot of it was getting up to speed, and we actually met with someone from the governor's, Duke Shepard from the governor's office, Mr. Prinz from Criminal Justice Commission, Nancy Cosine, Catherine Aylward from Office of Public Defense Services, Brett West from Oregon Department of Administrative Services, Mickey Cerise and Jerry Weybrandt from Oregon DHS, Department of Justice. I mean, we've really been exploring all the different possibilities because while, and this is, you know, it's funny because we're all on the committee. I think sometimes we have different maybe points of view of where we are, but it was easy kind of eliminating a lot of, like, Oregon Public Defense Services. That didn't take long for us to realize that just wasn't going to be a good fit. And I think the whole, the you know, there's this underlying kind of philosophical and desire to have CASA with the judicial branch, but you know, that's going to involve creating kind of a new structure, and we're just seeing that as it may be quite a bit of expense. So that is something that I think that CASA would really like to be with. I think how they perceive themselves as being with family, being in the court process, being with all the court players. I think we've actually all been really excited about the possibility of pursuing being with the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. It was something that I'd never heard of. Most, I think, the people hadn't. Duke Shepard recommended it, and we actually met with Kathleen Joy. And it gave us a different perspective of what that, the positive things of what that may do for CASA. I think CASA's having a hard time getting over the point of view that they wouldn't be with judiciary, but frankly, I don't know if you've had any knowledge with that group, but they manage all the federal funds for AmeriCorps, and they also work with volunteer organizations to just make them stronger, to get more bang for their buck, to just stretch their dollar, to build capacity, fiscal management, and they kind of trained me that the federal government is extremely strict on their money and how it's going to be used, and accountability and quality assurance. And so I was really impressed at what they may offer. It's a completely different point of view, you know, and maybe this is just a short term, and maybe we want to, because the Chief Justice has been talking about, you know, not that he wants to add anything more to the judiciary branch, but if in fact the legislature wants it to go to the judiciary, they're certainly open to creating, and this is, it's probably already been talked about, creating a different structure, similar to Oregon Public Defense Services, where they kind of built a different structure within the judiciary branch, so it would be separate, so there wouldn't be the conflicts as far as specific cases. But it could be managed by the judiciary branch. And so the idea, and this was more of a long-term idea, would be to align CASA with existing juvenile court programs, so, and that would be the Citizen Review Board and JSIP, the Juvenile Court Improvement Project, project or program, JSIP and CRB, and then add CASA. And so those three groups would kind of be separated. There would be what's called, let's see, from the Judicial Department to a standalone entity within the judicial branch. It would be called the Office of Juvenile Court Services. It would be, there would be a small Juvenile Court Services Commission. And so that's the idea, is if it did go into the judiciary, it would be that kind of a structure. It would be building a brand new structure. We've been hearing some scary figures about what that might cost. And that's why we're also seriously considering the Oregon Volunteer, I always get it wrong, Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. So that's where we're at. And I know as a judge, you know, judiciary's, we're not going anywhere. I mean, I think CASA needs to understand that, and this is what we, you know, we talk about putting some enabling language in, that, and language in, because, you know, we're going to continue to be partners, we're going to be continue to do training, we're going to, I mean, right now CASA is with the Commission for Children and Families, an executive branch. It would stay within the executive branch if it went to Oregon Volunteers Commission. We actually, I mean, this other idea sounds great, but that's where we are. We're going to meet again on November 28th. In the meantime, some CASA directors and the executive director for Oregon Volunteers Commission and the Chief Justice personnel, Leola McKinsey, they're all going to have a meeting, kind of talk about, you know, how this all might work. And we're moving fast. I'm just not used to, you know, I'm used to like 3 month setovers, so this is just all new to me.
Can't afford that right now. Any questions about this? From this? Yes?
Just one. Thank you, Chair. It's not a question so much as something that I run into, and it's basically explaining to the community, to my town halls, what CASA is. People do not know how many people are affected by it, what is available. This is the kind of thing that it would be good for me to have just some details, some numbers of the number of cases. What would be the case if this was not available to people, and we didn't have the kind of volunteer involvement or that we do have now. I ran into this as a part of a brief town hall about a week and a half ago, and after it, actually, someone coming up to me saying that they were concerned about this. They had heard about this program, and they didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be good to have something like that available, if you can.
And what if we could get that from the Commission for Children and Families?
That would
we'll
be good.
Look into that. Representative Harker?
We've got it in our office.
Terrific.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Echoing your sentiment, I did learn some more about the program at an event in Washington County recently, and the case was so compellingly made about the efficacy of this program and how effectively it leverages volunteers, fiercely dedicated volunteers, and we just have to find a permanent home for this.
I agree. Representative Greenlight.
Thank you. I was sitting here, I sit on the board of the Metropolitan Public Defenders, and I was wondering what the reasoning behind the assessment that it didn't fit into the public defense structure.
And Nancy Cozine and Catherine Elward, and I actually have their written report, because what we did is we asked each of these agencies, we had about four or five questions. Do you think it would work with your agency? What if, why not? Do you have another recommendation? I think, and I can grab it if you want to be real specific, because it's right here in my notebook, but I know generally they wanted to really concentrate on their mission, and they have scarce resources, and it would just create a lot of actual conflicts as far as, because CASAs are parties to a case. They actually can subpoena, they can have legal counsel in a permanency hearing, in a jurisdictional hearing. They're actually at the table. They are allowed, not that they do very often, but they're allowed to question witnesses, cross-examine. They don't very often because they're more of a friend of the court. That's the role they typically take. But think that was a big one, too, was the conflict.
May I follow that?
Follow up.
So that, I guess I understand that. I mean, I think of the agency that I've been involved with could expand their mission. It would be an expansion of mission and resources. But what I hear you saying is that they may be representing a child in a case, and then the CASA may end up needing to have an independent position.
Yes. So defense services may represent the parents, the child, and the CASA, you know, sometimes they go against what DHS is saying, sometimes they go against what the child's attorney is saying. It can take all different roles. It could be an adverse, they could have adverse interests, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One of the issues that we can't escape on this, if we had a real, honest, clean budget for CASA, it would be much easier. But most of the agencies are coming in and saying, we have our own budget problems, we're looking at this thing, there isn't enough money here to cover our costs of administering it, and we just don't want to play. So there are a number of possibilities we looked at where we might be able to get a fit, but not without the money to support it. And I understand their positions, because they're all concerned about the lack of budget they have for what they're doing now. And this was initially a problem last session when we talked to the Chief Justice, was that if you looked at what's happening to my budget over the past two or three sessions, and exactly where do you suggest I get the money to make this happen, although he's very supportive and very sympathetic of CASA. But it's bad timing, partly.
Any other questions? Thank you all so much. And I think you can see that this committee is very supportive of continuing CASA and will be supportive of any decisions that you make, either regarding legislation or further.
We'll have legislation, so that's not an issue.
Terrific. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Any further business in the committee? Thank you all for staying. We really appreciate it. I'm glad we weren't required to take the full 4 hours. We were pretty fast on our feet here. And we have committee meeting in January. I don't have that date now. Do you have that? Okay. Because I know this was changed. Originally, it was supposed to have been on Friday, and it was changed, and I know that fouls up people's schedules.
January 18th, 19th, and 20th, 2012. And
do we know ours?
I believe if it's the same as this time, it'll be on the 19th.
Which is Friday?
Which is a Thursday.
Representative Greenlake has asked that we meet all
Thursdays. You have Thursday?
That's fine with me, yeah.
It's subject to change. Obviously, they changed it from
last
time.
Can you cancel it?
To this meeting.
I know the
what time slot do you have?
Still at 2 o'clock on Friday.
It'd be the same one unless okay.
I think that's yeah. I think
yeah,
it's on
still showing as 2 o'clock on Friday. Now they changed it this time.
They changed it.
Yeah.
Change
it next time. So, okay, we'll see if that's going
to
be at 2 o'clock.
They tried to fit in the
okay, and we'll hopefully let you know soon enough to fill up your clear up your calendars. Any other business? Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much. I close the.
I guess I'll see you in about.